This cartoon was more towards the education, prevention, program kind, but it was so neat, I couldn't really resist the guy saying, you know, the doctor has numerous cases of gonorrhea, and the lady says, well, don't buy any because we still have a case of Merlot. The one great thing about being in a field where there's a really hot topic like cephalosporin resistance is that we have a lot of great sessions at meetings like this. We have lots of great talks. The downside is when you're the last person really talking about it, and by the time three talks yesterday and now Mark's talk today, I bet about 70% of my slides have been shown from the original talk when I landed 2 days ago. So I modified. I'm going to touch on these points, and I've added some which have not been presented outside of CDC yet, and some data which is new in the last few months, actually, since the abstracts were put in. And part of it's where we put on our mad scientist hat. So just page down.
Yeah.
All right, culture-based susceptibility testing. As it has been mentioned numerous times, there is less culture out there. But we still have places that are doing culture, and we're currently trying to get other groups to begin culture again. So it's important to maintain culture-based susceptibility testing. All right, as has been mentioned, the CLSI standards for Neisseria gonorrhoeae susceptibility, and this is, I'm just going to be dealing with the cephalosporins, both in MICs and zone diameters. For cefixime and cefpodoxime, or in ceftriaxone, it's less than or equal to 0.25. For cefpodoxime, it's 0.5. And you can see the various zones are for the different antibiotics. Now, there are no standards for E-tests, and I'd like to thank Mark for pointing out E-test again. but there's an example of an E-test. And as has also been mentioned, there are no breakpoints for intermediate or resistance. It's just susceptible or decreased susceptibility. Now, I want to make, here's one comment that no one did say. These numbers for zones and MICs have not changed in over 10 years, when every gonorrhea was probably highly, very highly susceptible. So we have undertaken a study, now that we have some organisms that have some higher MICs to these drugs, a comparison between plate dilution, E-test, and zone diameters. So for the argoplate dilution, and these are, I think, Kevin can correct me if I goofed, the ranges that we're running at CDC, cefixime is 0.004 to 1.0, cefpodoxime is 0.008 to 8.0, and ceftriaxone is 0.002 to 1.0. For the E-test strips, the ranges that are on the strips for cefixime and cefpodoxime are 0.016 to 256 micrograms per mil. And ceftriaxone is 0.002 to 32 micrograms per mil. For the disc diffusion, we're using like CLSI, we're using 5 microgram discs for cefixime, 10 for cefpodoxime, and 30 for ceftriaxone. So to date, we have tested over 120 different strains with various MICs have been tested. Now, this data is being correlated and put to the, and run through various programs to see how it all scatters out. And we have been in contact with CLSI before, and once we get all this done, which should be done soon, we'll contact them again to see see what they think of the data and if there can be any adjustments to some numbers that have been there for 12 years. Whoop, wrong one. Yeah, I hit the wrong button. Okay, auger plate dilution, MIC determination. This is, as people know, there's the media without antibiotic, and I'm just using one example here. Here's a medium containing 0.5 micrograms per mil of penicillin. You can tell this is a very, very old slide because we haven't used round plates in a very long time. I think this is a Joan Knapp original, and I think she's retiring at the end of the year, so you can tell how old this slide is. But you do get the point. You know, with no media, you'll grow at every spot you put on it, and as they'll start, as the amount of antibiotic goes up, they start falling off, and where you it first falls off, that's your minimum inhibitory concentration. And as I said, when an actual MIC run is done, there's just numerous plates for each one. You saw those ranges. So you normally get a whole stack full of plates sitting on the bench when you get done with this. It's a lot of work. And now here is F18, a disc diffusion, something that no one's shown a slide of yet. And here's the three discs, I can't read them from here, but there's ceftriaxone, cefixime, and cefpodoxime. And you can see you get nice big zones. F18 is actually it's a susceptible strain. If you do the E-test, and if you use larger plates, you can do three at a time. And you can see that this is almost all the way out to the end. Not completely, but this is a fairly, very susceptible strain. And now for our mad scientist to put the hat on. This next strain I'm going to show you has been generated in the lab. It is not a clinical isolate. It is 3502-1. And if you can see, at cefpodoxime, the zone has disappeared. The zone is zero. And all these others are much, much smaller diameter circles. If you look at E-test, you notice some of those don't move very far. And this is also 3502-1. And here's the part that hasn't been seen before. So if you compare argon dilution, E-test, and disc, for F18, you can see very susceptible for F18. If you compare 3502-1-2-4, you can see that the numbers are significantly higher. To the point where we're doing the auger dilution, where we're actually blasting out the top end on it. So this is where the E-test actually became very helpful. These have a cefixime MIC of 1.5 to 2.0. The cefpodoxime's a bit up at 64 to 48. And we're getting up to 1.0 to 0.5 on ceftriaxone. And if you look at the -1, -2, -4, you can see we're getting good repetitive results, and that's what we're seeing with most of the others. Like I said, I'm not going to sit here and show you row after row of comparisons. This is why I thought I'd bring in this new stuff where we have these lab-created high MICs. And I want to, at this point, say these are not genetically engineered. We just asked the bug to do what it could do through various selection methods. These actually were spontaneous mutants that grow at this high of level of these drugs, which shows us that the bug can do it, and it will do it. And as Mark said, you know, you realize the ones before from Japan and the European ones, they're hanging around at 1.0, 2.0. Okay, so we played a little more. I'm not going to go into the details of how we've constructed these. If anyone wants to talk about that, I can do that as an aside. At this point, these are some other comparing 3502, which is what we started with these. It has a mosaic pen A, and it starts with its initial ceftriaxone of 0.03, cefpodoxime of 1. And we first got this one when we weren't testing for cefixime, and we haven't gone back to do it yet. But we do some selections and transformations, and we get the AMP series. And as you can see, we're completely blowing out the auger dilution testing. The E-test is showing cefixime of 3, ceftriaxone of 1.5, and the cefpodoxime of 12 to 16. So, And you can see the zone diameters have decreased significantly from 28 to 12, 24 to 11, 35 to 30. So we played some more. We didn't bother at this point to do the auger dilution. We're talking to John's group and Kevin Pettis, that should be done pretty soon. We're going to go up to 16 on cefixime and ceftriaxone. We're not going to try and get to 128 on cefpidoxine. And as you can see, once again, the zones decrease again to the point where the cefpidoxine, you get no zone at all. And we have cefiximes up to 6.0, cefpidoxines at 128, and ceftriaxone at 8.0. I can guarantee you these things will be treatment failures. The standard panel of antibiotics we test, the only thing they're susceptible to is spectinomycin. So we won't let these out of the lab.
Thanks.
So this is the new stuff I was talking about. Now I'm going to shift over a bit to molecular detection methods, and I will be coming back to those high-level strains towards the end. This has been covered a bit, but resistance to penicillin and cephalosporins is a multi-locus phenomenon. Now we know most of the focus has been on Pen A, which is obvious because that seems to be the maybe final linchpin in the whole thing. But there's also Pon A, MTR, POR genes, and PIL-Q. PIL-Q we're actually looking into now because that last set of isolates that went to the APM 2-2, 4-2, and 5-1, the only difference between those and the APMs above is they became non-pileated. And this has been gone over a bit. I'm going to simplify it much more than Mark did because after seeing his, knowing what he was going to talk about. You basically have a wild type. You can have the original pen resistance was an amino acid insertion, the aspartic. Then there's also the various point mutations that can happen. And then there's the mosaics that he covered very well. And as I said, not all mosaics are exactly the same. There's numerous point mutations through those. I did have my little graph of the mosaic. I'm glad I took that one out, too. So just looking at, this is what we were seeing originally was, mosaics versus non-mosaics. You'd see this increase in all the cephalosporins would increase. The normal we would see for ceftriaxone is in the 0.03 to 0.06 range, whereas the non-mosaics, you can see, are very susceptible to these drugs. And one of the questions we wanted to ask, if a mosaic, and I'm going to focus on mosaic or on Pen A right now, as most people do, but you also have some of these same questions with some of the other mutations as the other genes as well. But I'm just going to focus on Pen A for this one. How many gonococcal strains contain a mosaic Pen A gene? Because that's sort of, this should be your groundswell of how many strains can develop higher levels, higher MICs. And also, are all mosaic Pen A genes closely related? We set up a detection method for Pen A's. We made a number of primer sets to detect that were specific for mosaic type and non-mosaic type. And then we made a pair to detect that inserted aspartic acid. We also made some pairs to distinguish base substitutions. After we did the PCR, we did DNA sequencing as necessary. We either use standard sequencing or pyrosequencing. And these are just cartoons. And these are not always the exact locations of the primers, but this was the idea of the plan to cover both the wild type and the mosaic and run PCR on these and see what we would, how many mosaics there were and how many non-mosaics. So in a real world, what we should see is green being wild type or susceptible, and you can see the MICs. Then the Pen A with the aspartic acid insertion, and you can see the MIC of pen goes up, but not ceftriaxone, and then a mosaic pen A, a 4.0 and an 0.6, where both go up. We started with 28 isolates with the MICs of 0.015 and 0.06. We had 12 isolates that contained mosaic pen A genes. The 16 were non-mosaics, and those, of course, tended to be towards the lower level. But, however, not all mosaic genes are created equal. Here's one example. This is what Mark would call a partial. This, for the red part, is once again a mosaic area, and the green part is wild type, and FA1090 is a wild type pen A gene. As you can see, this is just the end terminal of the gene. It goes on and on for the rest of it. But you can see it's coming, trugging along, and it gets to right here, and it goes from being a mosaic type pen A to a wild type pen A for the last 120 bases of that gene. So that made us think, okay, what else is out there? So instead of your standard way of thinking about these, and here's just three examples. The top one is the replacement. The bottom one is what we call another partial mosaic. This is the wild type in the green, the mosaic in the red, and this one actually even has the deinsertion in the wild type part. And as you can see, the MICs for both these go up. Now, this one, a mosaic-like three-prime sequence, has this little bit of wild type. Mosaic, and all the rest is wild type. And as you can see, its MICs don't do anything. They aren't increased. And this strain, 28BL, has been in the CDC collection since the 80s. So mosaics, some of this mosaic stuff has been going on a long time. Now, what we're in the process, because we would like to know how many potential strains contain mosaic genes, we're doing this into turning this into a Luminex detection assay. It's 96 well high format, so we get high throughput, and so we can do numerous reactions per well as opposed to all the single PCR reactions. And that is about ready to go to stand up. Now I'm going to kick over to genome sequencing. This is an example. This was one of the original ones that we got selecting. This has an MIC to ceftriaxone of 1.0. To do comparative sequencing analysis, we wanted to put it in an isogenic background, so we used 3502 as a recipient, and then we we got numerous transformants, all with MICs between 1 and 2. We've selected three, sent them to Harvard and the Broad, collaborating with them, and they did the whole genome sequencing. And right now, we've got between 85 and 90% coverage. And the only place, and the three transformants are on the top, and you can see there are different transformants because the red bar shows how much DNA was brought in, and they're all different length. Where that arrow is the only place on the whole genome where the same base change occurred. And it happens to be, guess where, in pen A. And it's actually right next to one of the amino acid changes that they see in the Japanese strain. So we're wondering if there's beginning to be hot spots in pen A mutation that are causing this. And here's the change, green the wild type, and 284-3-1, that's the original selected mutant. There's the switch, changes amino acid. Now we have another one that we did the same thing with SPL4, and its MIC also went up to 1. But we don't see a change there, and we don't see any additional change in pen A. So these are going to be in the process of beginning set up for whole genome sequencing, as are those really high MICs that I showed you earlier. So we're really getting into genome sequencing. There's also a collaboration with that Bob and I and others are setting up with Harvard and the Sanger to do basically all the increased MICs, the fixemes we have, about 120 or so, with matching susceptible isolates. So genome sequencing is getting hot, and a lot of groups are doing it for a lot of things. acknowledgement. Steve Johnson and Mark Burrows did a lot of the genetic work. Shi Lu did the disc diffusion and the e-test. Kevin Pettis, Manhar Parekh, who is now retired, and Samara Bowers did, they're in John Papp's group, and they did the MIC work, which we're very grateful for. And then Eli, the champion, is from another team in our group who helped us out with some transformation studies. And we're getting to the point where we're down to our last few bullets to kill the diplococci guy. So we need to be careful with how we use them and just be diligent and try and find new ways to detect this resistance so we can hopefully contain it a little bit. Thank you.
Thank you, David. Any questions for Dr. Trees? Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Our last speaker this... Oh, sorry. Was there a question? It's up to you. Come on, you're already standing up.
This is kind of a question that's geared towards all the presenters.
Could you speak really close to the microphone?
It's kind of a question that's geared toward all the presenters. I was kind of wondering why the CDC would make a recommendation to give dual therapy to a population that's known to be reinfected if the consequences is going to be reusing the same antibiotic, which eventually leads to resistance.
That's a Bob question.
Yeah, do you want to take
that? Sorry, that's a Bob question.
So, correct me if I'm wrong, if I misstate this. The question was, why are the CDC treatment recommendations recommending treatments that there's documented resistance shown?
Well, no, for dual therapy. For gonorrhea, the recommendation is dual therapy. And if resistance, a cause of resistance, could be overuse of antibiotics, why would they recommend dual therapy?
So it's about the dual treatment.
And overuse. I think one of the things that we know is that use of antibiotics in general is going to select for resistance. And we see that most, very pronounced in Neisseria gonorrhea, but we see it also with Staph aureus. You know, we've been dealing, as soon as we developed the antimicrobials, this became sort of an arms race. And we're going to be dealing with that forever. So one of the challenges, I think, is how do you address that? What we're hoping is with dual therapy, there is a theoretical basis for the hope that using two drugs will both improve outcomes but also might mitigate the development of resistance. And a similar model has been used with other microbes such as Pseudomonas aeruginosa and also in malaria, in which you get the bacteria from two ends, two different, the two antibiotics work in different ways. So that if one of the drugs doesn't work so well, then the other one would. But absolutely, anytime you're using antibiotics, there's a chance you're going to be selecting for resistance. So I think that's one of the inherent threats of using dual therapy. I think it's, the benefits, I think, are going to far outweigh the risk. But, there's potential that you're going to be selecting for resistance to two antimicrobials. But, as we're seeing development of resistance to this class, I think the idea of augmenting the treatment, I think, is going to give us the best chance of killing those bacteria before they can spread to other people. Does that answer your question?
Sort of. Because the population is a population known for reinfection. So it's like you're going to be doing the exact same process over and over again with the same population, which means eventually the resistance now is going to increase.
Right. I think that also speaks to, I think we're going to be, while we're using antimicrobials as the cornerstone of our of prevention also, I think it's important that we conserve antibiotics when we can and to use them effectively and also develop effective prevention strategies. Because, as you said, too, the use of antimicrobials is going to be somewhat limited because of the development of resistance. So I think it also speaks to the larger idea that Dr. Wachowski touched on yesterday, the need to really enhance other prevention strategies as well.
Just on as the moderator, I'll
sure.
open my mouth. And correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I think the other thing is that the resistance in gonorrhea isn't necessarily developed from over-treatment or under-treatment of gonorrhea, but exposure to antibiotics through other means. So that just because certain drugs are going to be used in treating gonorrhea doesn't necessarily mean that the use of those drugs is going to lead to further resistance. Mm-hmm. We're hoping that we can kill the bug really good so that it doesn't live long enough to infect somebody else and then pass on that resistance.
Right.
Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And the other thing that's different, I think, in terms of gonococcal resistance, that it's sort of a different paradigm from what we see with antimicrobial resistance for other bacteria, is that there's not as much of a domestic selection for these bugs with overuse of antibiotics. I mean, a lot of what we see also are global patterns, so stuff that emerges in Asia or other parts of the world that travels to us. So that's another wrinkle on it, too.